Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialist, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. And yes, welcome to today's webinar. So today we're going to be looking at anaesthetic emergencies. So emergencies can occur at any time in the peri-anaesthetic period. And remember, that starts from the moment any pre-medication drugs have been given. Now, your pre-med drugs don't necessarily have to be sedatives. It may be that you just give an opioid analgesic. And it extends into the recovery period. Your emergencies may be expected or not, and they may be due to the animal, any equipment that you're using, or drugs. Now, obviously, unexpected complications are more difficult to deal with because if we are expecting trouble, we can at least be well prepared. One heartening factor is that animals that arrest under anaesthesia have a significantly higher chance of successful resuscitation than those who are not anaesthetised at the time of arrest. But before we get to looking at the arrest situation, I'm going to explore the other common complications that we face during anaesthesia, and then we'll end by crashing and maybe burning. So although the mortality rates in veterinary anaesthesia have improved over the years, they are still much higher than those in people. Between 1990, which is when the original SEPSAF report was published, and 2008, when the Association of Veterinary Anaesthetists, the AVA, undertook a study looking at healthy and diseased dogs and cats. So that was ASA groups 1 and 2 were the healthy, and classification 3 to 5 were the poorly animals. So in those 18 years, the mortality rates have halved. But in the same time, the death rate in people fell from 0.01% to 0.004%. So obviously, we've still got a long way to go to catch up with our human counterparts. Emergencies are especially at risk, regardless of whether they are healthy or sick. Spotting the warning signs is the first step, and acting on them early is crucial. You've often got a window of opportunity to help your patient, but that window doesn't stay open forever, so getting in early is key. For a long time, the analogy has been between aviation and anaesthesia with regard to safety. So in the aviation world, they have the pre-boarding, pre-flight, in-flight checks, and then before landing, and that we can sort of equate that to pre-medication, induction, maintenance, and then emergence from anaesthesia. And the use of checklists for equipment, the patient, and drugs are now getting to be quite commonplace, and it's all done to prevent errors from occurring. And we've tightened up on many aspects of safety over the years, especially in this day and age of legal action. In 2008, the World Health Organization published the first checklist for anaesthesia and surgery, and this is now part of the Safe Surgery Saves Lives initiative. And they identified three phases. So before induction is called sign-in, and that's when people actually sign in on the day of surgery. Before skin incision is time out, when the whole team stop and take time to check. And then again, before the patient leaves theatre is called sign out. The AVA developed a checklist for veterinary anaesthesia, and this can be downloaded and adapted for specific practices. But the key to successful implementation of any checklist is it must be user-friendly. It's got to be able to be transported across to your practice, what the equipment that you use. So it's got to be well designed, and also it's got to be used by all relevant staff members. Okay, so now we'll move on to looking at some of the complications themselves, and we'll start with respiratory complications and airway trauma, which is often a result of human error, largely to do with the intubation process. So it can be something like using excessive force or a tube that's too big, using a stylet that's too long, and we'll look at that in the next slide. Not giving intubees enough time to work, or maybe not giving it any time to work. The patient not being deep enough. Those are some of the most common reasons. In that 2008 AVA study, endotracheal intubation in the cat was thought to be a contributing factor to the increased death rate, and that was in healthy cats. Any trauma incurred at induction can manifest as edema and obstruction during recovery, and also in cats especially, an unwillingness to eat. So if you're going to use a sort of fairly floppy ET tube, so the silicone tubes tend to be quite floppy, you're probably going to need a stylet so that you can actually insert the tube. But it's very important that the stylet does not protrude beyond the patient end of the tube. So if I can get my little pointer, I can't seem to, there he is. So here you can see that's the end of the tube. And then this stylet is going to actually irritate the laryngeal pharyngeal structures and cause damage. So we need to make sure that it's tucked well within the tube end if you're going to use a stylet. Other things that cause trouble at this stage is overinflating the cuff, and that can cause tracheitis, necrosis, and even tracheal rupture. If you need to put that much air into your cuff, then you need a bigger tube. Turning or moving the patient without disconnecting it from the circuit will also cause tracheal damage. And another fairly common thing that's still seen sometimes is using the oxygen flush, that emergency oxygen button, with the patient attached. That will cause volutrauma and barotrauma, so trauma to the lungs because of too much volume in them or too much pressure. Looking at regurgitation and aspiration, firstly, what's the difference between reflux and regurgitation? Well, reflux is when gastric contents reach the esophagus, and regurgitation is when they reach the pharynx and the mouth. And aspiration into the lungs can occur at that point. Now, regurgitation can occur in any patient. It's not just those that have recently eaten or those that are particularly prone to it. The lower esophageal sphincter tone is decreased because of drugs such as propofol and midazolam. And pain, stress and disease will cause delayed gastric emptying, meaning the stomach may have contents at induction, even if they have been starved for the required period. There was a study in 2017 that published figures showing that the incidence of regurgitation in dogs was up to 55% and 33% in cats. And the reported incidence of laryngospasm and aspiration pneumonia because of regurgitation was somewhere between 6 and 15%. So those figures are all quite high. We need to minimise the risks because aspiration can often be prevented. Competent intubation is very important. Esophageal intubation can trigger regurgitation, as can repeated unsuccessful attempts, especially in the cat where you get laryngospasm. And then leaning on the chest will lead to regurgitation, especially if your tube is not in the right place. If it's in the esophagus, you're certainly going to trigger a regurgitation. Correct patient positioning is very important, so they should always be in sternal recumbency with the head raised until the tube has been cuffed. Some animals are particularly at risk, and that would be your obese patients, those which are pregnant, and all the brachycephalic patients are at a high risk of regurgitation. And it may be that a proton pump inhibitor drug is given preemptively, so maybe you give omeprazole. Just to show you the lower esophageal sphincter, this used to be called the cardiac sphincter, but it seems to have changed its name now, and it's called the lower esophageal sphincter. But it's one and the same if you're used to hearing about it as being the cardiac sphincter. So here you can see it. It's just that bit there. These are endoscopic pictures. And then on the right, you can't see it. It's hidden here. Now, this is the esophagus of a healthy patient. We were just doing endoscopy. We weren't really expecting all of this reflux to be present in the esophagus. So it just goes to show you it can be there even when you're not expecting it. And these are the consequences of regurgitation. If it does occur, the single most important thing is to neutralise the acid. So you need to get the omeprazole into the system as soon as possible. The consequences can be fatal, and it's not only aspiration pneumonia that's the killer. Esophageal stricture is a real danger. The acid sits on the lower esophageal sphincter and it burns it, so it loses its elasticity. So in the end, the animal can't eat. Similarly, tracheitis, narrowing of the trachea as well, tracheal stenosis, will mean that the animal can't breathe, so you can get esophageal stenosis and tracheal stenosis. The picture in the bottom is lavage. It's not quite so popular now as it used to be. You can lavage the esophagus with warm tap water. There are no evidence-based theorems as to which solution to use. If you lavage, that's fine. And even if you don't lavage, you may extubate gently at the end of anaesthesia, leaving maybe half the amount of air in the cuff. Hyperventilation was the most common complication in a study that somebody called Mr. Redondo undertook in 2007, looking at the incidence of complications in anaesthetised dogs, and hyperventilation came out tops. There are lots of reasons why animals hyperventilate under anaesthesia, such as drugs, depressing the respiratory centres in the brain, maybe the position that it's in, it's too deep, too cold, those sorts of things. If it's allowed to continue, it leads to hypercapnia and acidosis. If it's purely respiratory acidosis, then it's in the lungs and it can be dealt with easily by the patient. But if you've got a pre-existing metabolic disease, so maybe it's got renal failure, then that has caused the metabolic acidosis, then we need to correct the respiratory part. It's easy to spot on a capnograph, but if you don't have a capnograph, then watch the chest and bag movements and count the respiratory rate. You can remedy hyperventilation with IPPV, and that will blow the excess CO2 off. But obviously, you need to try and find the cause and address that as well. And just be aware that some respiratory patterns are seen in brain-injured patients. So for those animals in particular, watch out for any abnormalities. So hypercapnia is an increased end tidal CO2 tension, and the tension of carbon dioxide in the blood, which is PaCO2, is virtually the same as the end tidal that you see on your capnograph. So you can see that capnography is an excellent tool for monitoring ventilation. But as I said, if you don't have a capnograph but your patient has got a slow respiratory rate, then just know that it will be retaining carbon dioxide, and therefore the end tidal and arterial concentrations will be high. So what happens in hypercapnia? Well, increased carbon dioxide stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, and that leads to an increased heart rate and respiratory rate. If you see these, just check that your patient's not in a light plane of anaesthesia. Prolonged hypercapnia leads to acidosis, and that in turn will lead to cardiac arrhythmias and subsequently bradycardia and bradypnea. CNS depression and apnea are likely to ensue. High CO2 also causes the cerebral vessels to vasodilate, and that will lead to increased intracranial pressure. And again, that's significant in head or brain trauma patients. So find the cause if you can. It may be equipment or patient related, and give IPPV to get rid of the excess carbon dioxide. Hypoxemia is defined as a low partial pressure of oxygen in arterial blood, and it's denoted with PaO2. Now, it can be moderate, which is a PaO2 of about 80 millimetres of mercury, and that's the beginning of desaturation. And at this point, your mucous membranes are still pink. Or it can be severe, which is a PaO2 of less than 60 millimetres of mercury. Inadequate delivery of oxygen to the tissues leads to hypoxia, although sometimes the terms are used interchangeably. So hypoxia, hypoxemia, there is a subtle difference. And this will lead to anaerobic metabolism, where you'll get lactate production and metabolic acidosis. Several reasons why it occurs. Maybe you've got lung disease, hemorrhage, the patient might be anemic, maybe your oxygen flow rate is too low, so they have a low inspired oxygen intake. Early compensation is by increasing the heart rate and respiratory rate and the respiratory effort. So when you see these things, don't be fooled into thinking the patient is light just because the heart and respiratory rates increase, because it may not be, and you making it deeper might just make everything worse. The PaO2 is not the same as the SpO2 reading that you see on your pulse oximeter. So you need to keep the SpO2 on your pulse ox above 96%, because 95% is the same as a PaO2 of 80 millimetres of mercury, which is the beginning of desaturation. Cyanosis is a late sign of hypoxemia, so pink membranes doesn't necessarily mean that all is well. A true SpO2 of 90% is a PaO2 of less than 60 millimetres of mercury, which is severe hypoxemia, and your patient might be in real trouble. We've got visual difficulties when we're assessing membranes. Maybe the lighting is poor, or if you've got fluorescent lights, then it makes the mucous membranes look blue or grey even, when they are actually pink. Maybe the membranes are pigmented, and also, your patient may have had an alpha-2 agonist agent, which will cause peripheral vasoconstriction. In anemia, this is a difficult one, because anemia, we've got inadequate hemoglobin, meaning insufficient oxygen transport. But if all the hemoglobin molecules that actually exist are fully saturated with oxygen, then your SpO2 pulse oximeter reading is going to be good. There are lots of reasons why animals stop breathing or just maybe don't even start breathing under anaesthesia, from temporary breath holding to apnea because of drugs, maybe getting colder, surgical reasons, or again, human error. Whatever the reasons, the warning signs must never be ignored. Respiratory arrest can quickly turn into cardiac arrest, so act on the warning signs. Any changes in respiratory pattern should be investigated. Look for sudden hypocapnia, or if you've got no capnograph, sudden changes in minute and tidal volumes by looking at the chest and bag movements. Are there shallow breaths with the bag not moving much? So what to do? Well, turn off the vaporizer. Quickly disconnect your patient. Stick your thumb over the patient end or a cap over the patient end of the tubes. Purge those tubes quickly, so now you can use your oxygen flush button to get all of the remaining gas out of the system and into the scavenge. Then reconnect your patient and IPPV using a suitable circuit. And do it calmly. Don't panic. You must allow the lungs to empty after giving a breath. However, get ready for cardiac arrest if the situation is looking urgent, so it may be that you need to call for extra hands and more help. Hypertension was the second most common complication in the Redondo study, and hypotension under general anaesthesia is very common, but often goes unmonitored or untreated. It's defined as a mean arterial pressure of less than 60 millimetres of mercury or a systolic arterial pressure of less than 80 millimetres of mercury. At those pressures, there's decreased perfusion to the vital organs, especially the kidneys, the brain, liver and the heart, and also the eyes. That's why they sometimes wake up blind, and it might be due to retinal ischemia or lack of perfusion to the visual cortex in the brain. Hypotension can occur because of vasodilation due to drugs, so all your inhalants will cause vasodilation. Maybe hypovolemia, hemorrhage, hypothermia, prolonged IPPV, putting them on a mechanical ventilator, lots of reasons why animals get low blood pressure. Renal autoregulation is the ability of the kidneys to maintain a constant blood flow between pressures of round about 60 to 150 millimetres of mercury, although some texts will quote 80 to 180 millimetres of mercury. That's the systolic pressure. And healthy animals maintain their blood pressure within this range in several different ways, such as autonomic nervous system responses, hormonal responses, and via the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Now, whether you've got a gradual drop or a sudden drop, it may be significant. So when you're monitoring your blood pressure, look at the trends. Trends are most useful because they allow time for action, not only when monitoring blood pressure, but when you're monitoring any parameter. So this is another of your windows of opportunity. If you see things are trending down slowly, there's going to get to a point where you need to intervene. However, you might get a sudden decrease, and that might be error. Somebody might be leaning on the cuff. So rule out error first, but quickly. Maybe you're expecting it. Handling the viscera can cause a reflex hypotension, and we see that often in bitch spays. Or maybe there's a vagal response, such as the ocular cardiac reflex, pressure on protruding eyes of brachycephalic patients. Some positions, such as extreme head-down position or just being in dorsal recumbency, will cause hypotension. I've mentioned here the aortocaval compression syndrome. It's unusual in small animals, but we must take care, especially with large dogs and pregnant bitches or animals with big splenic tumours or GDVs. This happens when the caudal vena cava and the descending aorta become compressed by something large in the abdomen. So we're looking at a large tumour or a pregnant uterus or a GDV. And venous return and cardiac output and blood pressure are all decreased. Now, it can trigger something called the Betzold-Jarisch reflex, which is bradycardia, hypotension and apnea with possible cardiac arrest. And also it's triggered when we suddenly change position quickly. So if you've got a large dog which you are inducing for a GDV or a cesarean and it's in sternal recumbency, don't flip it over onto its back too quickly. You need to do it slowly. So from sternal into lateral recumbency, give it 10-15 seconds, and then from lateral recumbency, nice and calmly and gently into dorsal recumbency. It is more common in large animals and horses, but it isn't unheard of in large dogs. So if there's no immediate equipment error or other obvious reason, your very first action is always going to be to turn the vaporizer down. That will decrease your vasodilation from your inhalant agent. There may be a compensatory tachycardia in the early stages of hypertension. So again, don't be fooled into thinking your patient is too light and make it deeper. So check all the parameters. It might be that you need to ask if you can give additional analgesia to compensate for the decreased vaporizer setting. But if that doesn't help, and it often will, if it's hypertension because of a routine elective healthy procedure, just decreasing the vaporizer will often bring it back into normal. But if it doesn't help, then a crystalloid fluid bolus of 5 to 10 mils per kilo can be given over 5 to 10 minutes. And usually that can be repeated once as long as there are no contraindications. Colloids with a couple of question marks. Colloids are now controversial. In people, there's evidence to show that they cause renal damage, coagulopathies and worse outcomes. So we We tend to avoid colloids unless there are specific indications. If you have blood pressure drugs, then they may be used after fluid boluses. So maybe you've got dopamine or dobutamine, which need to be given as a constant rate infusion, or ephedrine, which is a bolus. But early recognition, treatment and correction of hypotension improves the outcomes. So don't ignore a dropping blood pressure. Act on it. Hypothermia is difficult to define. Different texts give us different values. Usually in dogs and cats, we say it's anything below 37 degrees C, and in rabbits, it's anything which is not normal, which is 38 to 40 degrees C, so anything below that. It's easy to monitor temperature, yet still it's sometimes overlooked. The type of hypothermia that we see in anaesthetized patients is called secondary hypothermia. Primary hypothermia is exposure to cold. And drugs depress the normal thermoregulatory mechanisms, as well as causing vasodilation, leading to heat loss. Many body systems are affected when the animals get cold, especially cardiovascular, central nervous, and the immune systems. And remember that the MAC of your inhalant agent is decreased in hypothermia, so your isoflurane or sevoflurane becomes more potent. So again, as they get colder, you need to be knocking down the vaporizer setting. So shivering in our patients is not good, but when it stops, that's even worse. Shivering is a reflex that generates heat, and it's triggered when the core temperature drops below a critical level, which is called the hypothalamic set point. When the production of heat is not enough to fight the drop in temperature, shivering stops. And in dogs and cats, that's at around about 34 degrees C. Active warmth is recommended for any patient with a temperature of 35 degrees C or lower. And if it's not addressed, ventricular arrhythmias occur around about 30 degrees C, and ventricular fibrillation, leading to cardiac arrest and death at approximately 28 degrees C. It's thought that heat is lost most quickly in the first 30 minutes of anaesthesia. It's about 2.5 degrees C is lost in the first half hour, and then another 2 degrees C over the next couple of hours. So because of this, for short ops, such as your cat neuters, the temperature can still carry on decreasing during recovery. So just because they wake up doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be warming up. There are various ways that we can warm our patients up. Passive warming with blankets is okay for mild hypothermia. It's the slowest method, and the patient must be able to shiver. And then active external warming is for moderate hypothermia, and this is what we should use if the temperature is 35 degrees C or lower. So we're looking here at giving active heat, such as circulating warm air with a bear hugger, or maybe using your hot dog warming system. But when you're using this, the heat source, which is your heated blanket, should be in contact with at least 60% of the body surface for it to be effective. And then we've got active core rewarming, which is for severe hypothermia. It's used in people, but not really in animals. It's invasive because it entails the use of warm lavage fluid instilled into the body, and that's either into the chest or abdomen, or the stomach, or the urinary bladder. It's got the quickest results, and we do need to be careful of rebound hyperthermia. So obviously, if you're already in a body cavity, that's fine. So during laparotomy, when the surgeon lavages with warm fluid, you see that they warm up nicely. But it's not something that we would do specifically in the veterinary world to warm a hypothermic patient. We would normally use a combination of the other methods. So ideally, we need to prevent hypothermia from occurring in the first place. It's got lots of bad effects. It's the biggest cause of bradycardia and delayed recovery. Shivering is uncomfortable, and it also increases the oxygen demand by up to about 200%. And the oxygen demand is already increased due to anaesthesia. It's physiologically stressful as well, resulting in increased heart rate and blood pressure, and it aggravates pain. So take time before and straight after induction to use measures to keep your patient warm. Okay, so now we come to the crash and burn scenarios. There are many reasons for cardiac arrest, including all of those that I've listed here. Anesthetic overdose, remember, can be because of inhalant as well as injectable agents. And a lot of these reasons bring us back to human error. So we've got all the hypos and one hyper: hypoxemia, hypovolemia, hypoglycemia, hypercapnia, and hypothermia. When the heart stops, the immediate problem is lack of delivery of oxygen to the tissues and lack of removal of carbon dioxide and waste products from them. Irreversible brain damage occurs in the absence of oxygen, so rapid delivery of oxygen to the brain is needed during resuscitation. You've got about 5 to 10 seconds maximum to confirm cardiopulmonary arrest, so here's your window of opportunity. Be familiar with the signs and act on them. Cardiac arrest may be preceded by respiratory arrest, and any changes in respiratory pattern, rate, or depth can warn of impending arrest. It's not always preceded by respiratory arrest, though, or maybe only for a very short time. You may only have a couple of seconds. Sudden changes in heart rate and ECG complexes can also occur. There may be loss of pulses. Now, you need to be feeling the peripheral pulses when you're monitoring anaesthetized patients, not the femoral central pulses, not the heart. If you lose the peripheral pulses, but you still have a central pulse, that's your window of opportunity. You can rescue your patient. However, if you only feel the femoral pulse or listen to the heart, that doesn't give you any useful information other than you know your patient's alive. And you'll never know at what point the peripheral pulses were lost. So you've got no window to rescue your patient. If you have a Doppler taped in place and you're listening to Doppler FM and it suddenly disappears, find out why. Sudden hypercapnia may be seen as there's no exhalation of carbon dioxide. Your surgeon asking if everything is okay at your end because it's very bleeding or very dark blood their end, they are not what you want to hear. If your patient suddenly becomes very deep for no apparent reason, so all of these are reasons really to be afraid. So for resuscitation, we follow the RECOVER guidelines. RECOVER is the reassessment campaign on veterinary resuscitation. And these are guidelines for resuscitation in dogs and cats. They're due to be reviewed in 2020. So just keep an eye on the website and see if anything changes. When I say the website, it's recoverinitiative.org. Do not Google recover.org. That's not a website that we should be looking at. So they're evidence-based guidelines for optimal resuscitation in dogs and cats. And they are in five main parts: prevention and preparedness, basic life support, advanced life support, monitoring, and post-resuscitation care. And we'll look at each of these in turn. So starting off with prevention and preparedness, I always think it should be the other way around, because if you're prepared, maybe you can prevent. Anyway, starting with the crash trolley, everyone's crash box is going to be different, but it's important that all staff know where it's kept and how to get into it, and that the contents are replaced as necessary and that everything is in date. There should be algorithms to follow. Algorithms are rules, instructions, and calculations. Communication, teamwork, and leadership are really important. It's very important that a leader is appointed within seconds and roles are issued very quickly. Now, the leader doesn't have to be a veterinary surgeon or a qualified veterinary nurse. RECOVER have shown that if people know their roles, it doesn't matter, as long as the leader is somebody who is appointed and who knows what to do, and that the rest of the team respect that leader. It may be your leader is a student veterinary nurse or the ambulance driver. If you've got too many people, you need to get rid of the rubber neckers. It's a bit like morbidly watching an accident on the motorway, isn't it? It just blocks everything up on all roads. So if you've got too many people, get rid of those that aren't needed. And there should be a debriefing after the event. The other thing is to know the alarm system for your practice. Maybe it's a button that you press, maybe it's a telephone code that you dial, but more than likely you just shout for help. Regular training sessions are invaluable. Recover showed that resuscitation skills deteriorated within weeks of learning, even using high quality aids, and they recommend every 6 months or sooner. If you do simulation sessions, when it happens for real, you will know what to do and your own adrenaline will kick in and you will go on a sort of muscular memory. You'll just automatically do what you're supposed to do. So here is a simulation session. This is my mannequin called Dido, and Dido and I travel around the country doing CPR workshops for practices. The key is that you must keep them entirely lifelike. So once I've said that Dido's crashed here, nobody wanders in saying there's a telephone call for so and so, and that so and so doesn't wander out to take the call. We have to treat it as a real life situation. And these workshops, I have to say, are great fun. But also, we've had on more than one occasion, we've had tears when if Dido doesn't live, then people have cried about it. So keep it real. As I said, you need a leader who could be anybody who knows the roles. You need several people to do compressions and ideally someone to do IPPV, and you need a runner for drugs and fluids, and somebody that may or may not be the leader to record the information. So five people is great. Three is the minimum recommended for success. And as well as keeping those records so that we can see how the patient's doing, it does allow us to look back and look at the events and see if we could have done anything differently. Closed loop communication is something which is carried out in human resuscitation and it should be used in veterinary CPR as well. It's another thing that is done to prevent errors. So what happens here is the sender gives an instruction to the receiver. The receiver repeats it back to make sure it's right, and the sender says yes to agree, or obviously no if it's not right. So, for example, somebody says to me, give 0.2 mil adrenaline IV. I repeat, I'm going to give 0.2 mil adrenaline IV, and that person says yes. So the loop is opened by issuing the instruction, which is then repeated back and clarified to close the loop. So, a good team leader, a well-trained team, regular simulation sessions will all improve patient survival rates. Basic life support must be started as soon as possible to increase the chances of survival. The longer the delay, and I'm talking 10 seconds, the worse the predicted outcome. So is it ABC, which it always traditionally used to be, or CAB? Well, it does depend on the reason for arrest, but more than often it's CAB nowadays, so compressions first. And certainly if there's only one of you, starting compressions is the most important thing. Obviously, if there's sufficient staff, ventilation must be given. And there's two methods of performing compressions. We've got the cardiac pump, which is used for cats and small dogs, or for keel-chested breeds, and compressions are given directly over the heart to encourage forward blood flow. The animal can be in right or left lateral recumbency. Recover found no evidence to say that right is better, which is what we always used to do. It must be on a firm surface, and the table must be the correct height, otherwise compressions won't be effective. So you either need to stand on a stool, or it might be your animal needs to go on the floor. Ideally, have the spine facing you. If your patient's really small, then you can do it one-handed circumferentially, but normally we'd use two hands with the fingers interlaced, one hand on top of the other, your elbows are locked, your shoulders are over your elbows, no leaning forward. And then the thoracic pump is used for large dogs in lateral recumbency or barrel-chested dogs of any size in lateral or dorsal recumbency. and the widest part of the chest is compressed to increase intrathoracic pressure and encourage forward blood flow. So for thoracic pump, if the patient's in lateral recumbency, the widest part is midway along the chest, and if it's in dorsal recumbency, the widest part is the sternum. So here we've got a bulldog which crashed straight after induction. So if we just go around the headless people, let me just grab my little pointer man. So this person here is doing IPPV. We'll come back to this one. This one here is doing the compression, so you can see the ham position. And then I don't know if you can see behind, but we've got other people lined up to take over. Forget this one for the minute. And this is the leader. The leader is issuing all the instructions and keeping the paperwork. Now, as I said, this dog crashed straight after induction, which is why it's on a vet bed. That's less than ideal because you do need that surface to be firm for the compressions to be effective. So here we've got somebody who's ready to whip the vet bed out, and this person over here is just stabilizing the head and the tube whilst that happens. This dog was resuscitated 5 times, I think, until the owners arrived, and then it was euthanized. So this table sums up the main points of basic life support. All of this information is available on the Recover website. So for dogs and cats, regardless of size, it's 100 to 120 compressions a minute, and that's about 1 to 2 per second. Now, you will read or you will be told that there are songs that you can sing, Nelly the Elephant, if you're of a certain age, Bee Gees, Staying Alive. I think there are other songs to sing. Are you going to be singing while you're resuscitating something? Not really. It's one of the few occasions, really, during your working day when you're not singing. The chest is compressed a third to half of its width, and that will maximise cardiac output. Now, we only generate 20 to 30% cardiac output anyway with closed chest compressions. You must allow venous return, so a full chest recoil must be allowed to increase cardiac filling. IPPV is 10 breaths a minute, which is 1 every 6 seconds. Ideally, the breath will synchronise with a compression, but that's really difficult to actually do. A duration of 1 second for the breath will give you a tidal volume of 10 mils per kilo, which is what we're aiming for. You only want to move the chest to what you would expect if it was breathing normally. Now look, it takes about 1.5 minutes for blood to get round the body and perfuse the brain, so there is no point in stopping and having a break within 2 minutes. So cycles of basic life support are 2 minutes. If you stop, it takes another minute to get back to where you were before you stopped. And that's the same for any break. At the moment, they recommend the breaks are 10 seconds or less, ideally 3 to 5. And I think we'll find in 2020, when they review the Recover guidelines, they will actually decrease that 10-second break to something that's shorter. Don't worry about assessing the patient. You won't be able to feel for pulses unless you've got plenty of people. Never stop to auscultate the heart or assess the ECG. You won't be able to assess the ECG while you're doing compressions because there'll be interference. You just need to keep going. Checking the patient is done in the very quick 5-second break between cycles. So the leader will line up the next compressor. And it's jolly hard work if you're doing it properly. And if you're tired, and it may be after only 30 seconds, compressions will be ineffective. So if the leader thinks that's happening, or if you say, I need to be out, then someone takes over with no break. If the compressor is leaning over the animal, then he or she must be swapped out. Even if they say that they're okay to continue, this is when you have to respect your leader. If you're Billy No Mates and you're doing all of this on your own, then the chances of successful resuscitation are very slim, to say the least. But the rule of thumb then is to do 30 compressions and then 2 breaths. 30 compressions, 2 breaths. Advanced life support isn't stage two of the process. It's more something that's going on alongside basic life support. And it's the DEF, which is drugs and vascular access, defibrillation if it's a shockable rhythm, ECG and other assessments, fluids and open chest CPR and follow-up. And constant monitoring is of paramount importance because rearrest is likely. There's little evidence to show that any drugs or fluids improve the outcomes, but those are the drugs that you might see in a crash box. You need an emergency drugs chart to give the dose in mils per range of weights. You won't be having time to do any calculations. So we've got adrenaline, which is used to start the heart at low doses to start with, atropine, which treats bradycardia, lidocaine, we need the preparation without adrenaline, treats cardiac arrhythmias in dogs. It may be seen, you might be using it in really, really low doses in cats. I've put sodium bicarbonate here because metabolic acidosis occurs due to hypoxia and ischemia, as well as the retained CO2 and lactate production. However, nowadays we only give sodium bicarbonate if cardiac function has not been restored after 10 minutes or more of CPR. If return of spontaneous circulation occurs within that time, then the effects of acidemia will be resolved and sodium bicarb may make things worse. And then we've got blood pressure drugs and maybe reversal drugs. Giving your drug via a central vein is best, but it's unlikely that you've got a central vein catheterized, so it's normally going to be a peripheral vein. Via a peripheral vein, again, it takes 2 minutes and plenty of flush for the drug to reach the central circulation. We're looking at 5 to 20 mils for cats to small, medium-sized dogs and 30 plus mils for large dogs. So you need to take that amount into account when calculating your fluid volume and rates. Use sterile saline or sterile water for flush. And if you're giving it via a peripheral vein, then raise the limb for about 30 seconds after administration. You can give adrenaline, atropine, lidocaine and naloxone via the intratracheal route using a long dog urinary catheter threaded down the ET tube. We don't know the pharmacokinetics for this route and absorption is unpredictable. Also, there are no data for doses. Generally, you'd use somewhere between 2 and 10 times the dose, maybe dilute 50-50 with saline and then flush it down with 1 to 5 mils of flush. I've put intraosseous catheter here. If you use the intraosseous route, it's the same as using a central vein with rapid absorption, but you're unlikely to have an intraosseous catheter in place. Never intracardiac, not in this day and age. Back along many, many years ago, we used to do this, but we didn't know any better. There are lots of reasons now. Trauma to the myocardium, hemorrhage, lung puncture, trauma to the coronary artery. Lots of reasons we know better than to stick it into the heart. So here we've got some open chest CPR going on. Again, this is a dog which crashed straight after surgery, actually, on its way back. So the chest was opened quickly. We knew the owner wanted open chest CPR if necessary. So on the left, you can see that the surgeon has got both hands encompassing the heart. And then on the right here, here you can see we've got the paddles. So we're getting ready for internal. Sorry, I don't think the pointer came. Here are the paddles. So we're getting ready here for internal cardiac compressions. Again, this dog was defibrillated and unfortunately this dog did not make it either. Fluids, well, normal volemic patients, fluids aren't necessary at all. And in fact, they are contraindicated. But as we're talking about animals that crash under anaesthesia, they're going to be on IV fluids anyway. For hemorrhage and hypovolemia, it might be that they're needed in large volumes and at high or more likely bolus rates. So we're talking here of crystalloids, whole blood or blood products. Remember, though, to take your flush volumes into account to avoid hypervolemia. Monitoring is tricky. You can't stop to assess unless it's the 5 second break between your cycles of basic life support. For the ECG, we've got three proper arrest rhythms. We've got asystole, which is the flat line, pulseless electrical activity, where you've got electrical activity but no pulse, and ventricular fibrillation, which is the rhythm that's shown in the photo. Of those, ventricular fibrillation is the only rhythm that's suitable for defibrillation. It's the least common reason why animals arrest, about 10% only, but the most common one in people, which is why you see defibrillation in people a lot more often. The majority of veterinary CPA is because of asystole or pulseless electrical activity. Capnography is really useful. An end-tidal CO2 of 15 millimetres of mercury indicates good CPR technique, and it's associated with improved, at least short-term, survival. And an increase in end-tidal CO2 is a good sign. Hypercapnia is going to occur with return of spontaneous circulation because the CO2 that's built up in the tissues is suddenly recirculated. It's taken to the lungs and it's exhaled. So you must continue to ventilate to expel the CO2. The heart rate, pulse, pupillary light reflexes, maybe they can be assessed with the ECG and your very, very quick breaks between your cycles of basic life support. How long to go on for is difficult. It depends on a combination of factors, the owner's wishes, if you know them, their budget, sadly. CPR resuscitation is very expensive. They may not be able to afford it, and that's a sad and maybe an ethical one. The reason for arrest, it might be young, healthy, elective, bitch spay. Nobody ever expected it to arrest. You might be going for more than an hour. Or if it's a poorly patient with a poor prognosis, you may give up within 20 minutes. The rearrest rate following successful CPR in small animals is high at about 70%. Obviously, that does depend on the reason for the initial arrest. But we need to monitor closely. If the animal is conscious, look for a change in mentation, because if they suddenly look depressed, that can indicate impending doom. Ongoing fluids might be necessary to support the circulation, and long-term ventilation may be required to expel the CO2 and ensure effective gas exchange. So try not to extubate them if possible until they're normocapnic, and then maybe give them supplemental oxygen. Keep the ECG on in the recovery phase if they recover to consciousness, because abnormal complexes might be seen. But damage done during arrest manifests as this post-cardiac arrest syndrome, and we see things like brain and heart damage, acute kidney injury, acute lung injury, ischemic reperfusion injury, multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, maybe SIRS, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and death. So all of these things might be the straw that breaks the camel's back, even if you have actually managed to successfully resuscitate them. So being well prepared goes a long way to affecting the outcome. Know what to look for and act on any signs before it's too late. Use your windows of opportunity. As a team, devise your own specific practice protocols for dealing with emergencies. And as I said, regular simulation sessions are so important. Then in a real life emergency, you'll know what to do. And that can mean the difference between life and death. So the next clip is a little video. So this is Marley. Marley was a young police dog in training. He was referred with dyspnea and loss of body condition. And you can see here, you can see his ribs just while he's breathing. The video here will show you also the increased respiratory rate. So look at the work involved in breathing. We're supporting his head here because actually he was very exhausted simply by breathing and trying to stay alive. And we're trying to keep stress to an absolute minimum, because obviously that increases the work that he would have to do to keep himself oxygenated. So Marley had an emergency thoracotomy for pyothorax and placement of bilateral chest drains. He crashed under anaesthesia, and CPR at that time was successful, but he was very poorly afterwards. You can see he's got two nasal oxygen catheters in. He's got two chest tubes. You can see the one just here. That's a chest tube there. He has got one on the other side. He's got a rectal SpO2 in place, and he's on this blue mattress, which is a cool mattress, because he was pyrexic. Now, when that happens, that indicates sepsis or SIRS, the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, which is not good. So he didn't have a good outlook. 18-month-old dog. So, you know, really, we were all very sad. But to end on a happy note, after all the doom and gloom of those dogs that have crashed and burnt during this presentation, here he is, chest drains out, boots on, bag packed, ready to go home. And he's since completed his training and graduated, I suppose, as a sniffer dog in the police. So for every however many number that don't make it, and often that's a high number, there will be one that does. And it's that one that makes those simulation sessions and our whole job worthwhile. Thank you very much for listening today.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.